This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby will be back tomorrow. Happy Budget Day to you as we await what might be the most unanticipated financial document in memory. Unanticipated because we already know the highlights announced over the past 3 weeks by the Prime Minister and Finance Minister. The biggest promise is to build 3.9 million homes by 2031. Part of a housing strategy which includes a bevy of measures and billions of dollars for building more homes and making it easier to own or rent. But will Justin Trudeau keep his promises? Will he be around long enough to implement them? And will you vote for him based on his budget promises? 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-744-740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
Excellent timing for our recovering politicians. Lisa Raitt, former federal conservative deputy leader. John Molloy, former Ontario cabinet minister, Liberal Ontario cabinet minister. And Sherry DeNovo, former NDP MPP. Hello to you all.
Hi, Jane.
Well, I know Libby wrapped up last week's chat asking you your thoughts on the coming budget, but now we have a little more intel, including a new tax on the wealthiest Canadians and some corporations. I guess, Lisa, this is how they're going to pay for all these promises. Good idea. What do you think?
I think we need to dig a little bit deeper, Jane, into it, because the promises that the Liberals have made to date in the last couple of days really are about funding and spending money in the future. Tax increases today actually happen today. It's a very efficient and a very ruthless way in order to raise money. So they are going to absolutely be raising more money from corporations and from individuals in the short term, if that's the route that they go down. But the spending that they have actually promised is reliant upon cooperation by both the provinces and municipalities, which, as we know, can be a pretty difficult thing to get in this current political climate. So for me, I don't know whether or not one is necessarily going to offset the other. It'll be really interesting to see what route they end up going down in terms of what new taxes they're bringing in. And the reaction of Canadians to it, because the old salt is, if you're under 30, you're not going to care about the increases because they don't impact you. But I would say that that may not be the case anymore.
Sherry, what about from an NDP perspective, from Jagmeet Singh's perspective, the idea of including a new tax on the wealthiest Canadians, corporations? This sounds like something very much that Jagmeet Singh would be interested in. Wondering if you think it might have been a requirement from Jagmeet Singh to continue supporting the minority Liberals.
It could have been. I don't know about the back room, but I can tell you that it's timely. Prior to 2021, taxes on the wealthiest were the biggest Canadian corporations anyway, 19%, and they've dropped to 15%. 9 out of 10 Canadians want to see more tax being levied on the wealthy and on corporations, whether that's windfall taxes from the pandemic, whether it's simple, across the board, trying to close up the tax haven loopholes. People are tired, especially the middle class, of paying, a significant portion of their income on taxes and seeing billionaires and large corporations paying about the same level as somebody, almost on social assistance. So just because they've got good lawyers. So, mm-hmm. There's some real inequity here, and I think it has to be addressed.
John Molloy, I was speaking with Lauren Bozanoff this morning on the Morning Zoom with Sam and Jane, and he thinks that this will be a very popular move with Canadians should they apply a new tax on the wealthy. A good idea from your point of view?
I mean, I think at the end, the Liberal Party is acting like a Liberal Party. They're making some key investments in areas that Canadians are concerned about, and in a time of great income inequality, they're taxing. Well, we don't know until we see the details, but if you believe the rumors and the media reports, they're going to be taxing the wealthiest. That's kind of what a centrist or perhaps a little bit center left Liberal Party is all about. And I've been sort of chuckling at a lot of the criticism that you've seen in the media the last few weeks that have sort of been saying the Liberals shouldn't act like Liberals. I mean, this is what they were elected on, and they're making some key investments in very popular areas. I think it's has the potential, certainly until we see the details, we won't know, but has the potential to be very popular with Canadians.
Is this a pre-election budget, do you think, Lisa Raitt? Do you think this will be the final budget for the Trudeau Liberals before the next election? There could be one more a year from now.
Yeah, we're definitely off cycle in what kind of budget you anticipate. I would predict that the budget you'll see tomorrow should look like a budget that you would put out just before an election. However, I don't think we're going to have an election this year. I do think it's going to be next year. And as a result, it's not really matching up. Usually you have a budget going into the second last year that allows you to do some stuff, but you keep it really low key and hopeful be able to have the revenue for the next time around. I think that the Liberal Party has taken a look at what's been happening to their eroding vote and have decided that they're just going to throw everything at the wall now and try to reverse the loss of voters. And as a result, we're seeing an election budget in a non-election year.
Right. It's really interesting. I know you misspoke there. The budget is coming down later this afternoon. Sherry, just thinking about that whole idea of the possibility of two more budgets for the Trudeau Liberals before an election, do you think that the political leaders, including Jagmeet Singh and Pierre Poilievre and Justin Trudeau, do you think that they feel that we won't be going to an election until the fall of 2025, or do you think that there's a feeling it could be sooner?
Actually, I think it's going to be going to wait as long as possible. I mean, if you look at the polling, I mean, why in the world, unless you're Poilievre, would you want an election tomorrow? So just for political reasons alone, I think they're going to wait. The problem with that, of course, is that, you know, especially for the NDP, I think it, you know, more and more propping up of the unpopular Liberal brand, which is, I think, a problem politically. So it'll be interesting to see, but definitely no election soon.
And John, what do you think about this election budget in a non-election year?
Well, I think, listen, the Liberals are coming from way, way behind in the polls. That's a reality. But I think most Canadians have noticed over the past several weeks, even month or so, some new energy there, some new ideas coming forward in an attempt to contrast their position with the other parties. I've noted the Liberals have if I put it this way, stopped apologizing. I mean, as I said a few moments ago, they're being Liberals again. And listen, they've got a long way to go, but I think that contrast is going to happen. I mean, it was interesting in the news clip to hear Pierre Poilievre saying how horrible life is for Canadians, and yet what he's offering is cuts. So the Liberals are going to say, yeah, there's some challenges for Canadians, and we have some key investments, some spending that's coming on, versus Pierre Poilievre, who's offering cuts. It's going to take time to make those arguments, and I think when you're as far behind as the Liberals are, they've got to be aggressive, and they've got to start literally today in trying to pull it together, and I think it'll be fascinating to see the next couple of months.
Yes. Well, let me run this idea by you. And as a reminder, I would really like our Zoomer Radio listeners, you out there, to call in and answer the questions that I asked off the top of the show. Do you think Justin Trudeau will keep these promises? Will he be around long enough to implement them? Will you vote for him based on his budget promises? Or have you had enough and plan to vote otherwise in the next election, regardless when it is. 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. It's Jane for Libby today, along with Lisa Raitt, Sherry DeNovo, and John Malloy. So here's the concept. Lisa, we know that people in the 55 to 70 age group are the most likely to vote. Those people, those Canadians, they vote, 8 out of 10 vote in every election. Do you think, and there's been much speculation around how this is going to be a budget for the younger generations, the millennials, the Gen Zs, who typically don't vote at election time? Is this a strategy, do you think, by the Liberals to attract voters who've never voted before?
100%. This is absolutely dedicated to trying to woo the voters, I'm going to say, under the age of 40. They lost a big chunk of the voters in 2015 that voted in favor of them by the time they got to 2021. In fact, I looked at it today, and it was like 10% drop off of voter turnout in that key demographic. So they definitely want to make sure that their vote shows up. They want to have that under 40 vote come back out, which gave them their majority in 2015. And they're probably thinking that this is a package that's going to bring them back. I would just offer this perspective very quickly, Jane. Pierre Poilievre doesn't need people to come out and vote for him. He's going to have people come out for him for sure, but he's not trying to woo people. What he needs to do is to motivate people to come out to vote against Justin Trudeau. And that's the key here. It's that he needs the people to show up as well, but he wants them to vote against Justin Trudeau. And right now, that is kind of where the mentality is of this generation. They don't like him.
But isn't that what Pierre is already doing, Lisa?
No, he is. And he'll have to now utilize this budget to say that, you know, Mr. Trudeau is introducing this. It's last minute. He's not really going to, it's not going to be helpful for you. And that's going to be playing out. It's going to be after those votes, Trudeau needs to get them back to the polls in his favor. And all Pierre needs to do is to make sure that they show up to vote out Trudeau.
Sherry, what are your thoughts on this being a budget for the young people who may not have ever voted before?
Well, certainly that's the intent here. I wouldn't write off seniors so quickly, though, this being Zoomer Radio, in terms of them, sorry, losing my voice here, voting conservative. We do remember that Harper cut their pensions. So, I mean, I think there will be a lot of kind of looking back at what conservatives did when they were in power and Pierre was there. So do you want that again? I mean, this is a communications race. And so far, the conservatives have been winning hands down. But I'm with John a little bit. I think the Liberals are kind of feeling some wind beneath their wings. But I also remember that last gasp of Kathleen Wynne's government and what happened there. So that we're not going to see an election anytime soon for sure. But when we do, is it enough to save the Liberal brand? Don't know.
Of course, we all remember Kathleen Wynne in the final weeks of that last election campaign. Sorry, I'm sorry, not sorry. That is not what we're experiencing yet with the federal Liberals, right, John?
No, I mean, listen, the challenge the federal Liberals have is to, well, obviously they've got to deal with the incumbency and the fact that it doesn't matter what party, well, you've been in power long enough. It's sort of like a fresh fish or house guest. After a few days, you want them to leave. So they've got to deal with that. But they also have a real problem with contrast. They've been unable to have people give people a choice between themselves and the Conservatives. I mean, you know, Pierre Poilievre is finally, and we've seen a little bit of this as a carbon tax, he's finally had to respond to some tough questions as to what exactly he will do to address some of these issues. He's been very good at painting a bleak picture of what's happening in Canada. He keeps talking about cuts. You know, he's going to cut government spending. My rent's going to go down. I don't think it's going to work that way. And in fact, some of the people who are putting their hopes in him are going to suffer through the cuts that he's put forward. That message needs to get out there, a contrast between, you know, good old-fashioned Liberal, we're going to make some investments, we're going to tax the rich, something that Canadians seem to have been very comfortable with, and a party that's been focused on cuts. And if they can get that contrast, if they can get more and more questions asked of Poilievre, I think they're going to see themselves go up in the polls. At the end of the day, after this many elections, after this long in office, I'm realistic. I realize it's going to be very, very tough. But hopefully, they're going to start to get to that point where people are actually having that contrast between the two parties.
Yeah, and I will ask you all three this question too: is it time for Justin Trudeau to lose his quote unquote sunny ways and take a different tack in this last year and a half before we have an election? Eventually, we will have an election, but the latest we'll have it will be the fall of 2025. Let's go to the phones now. 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. Does it matter to you what the Trudeau Liberals are promising, or have you had enough after 9 years of Justin Trudeau as the Prime Minister? Sheila in Mississauga, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, you know, it's a game of a dice. They are in the parliament school with a magic eraser, rewrites, writes, says, we have to listen and we have to vote. We don't have much of a choice. No matter who you're going to vote, they're going to change the things their way.
And Sheila, if a federal election were held tomorrow, do you know who you would vote for?
No, I'm a very confused person. I have no trust in any of them.
Okay. But will you vote?
We'll see when it comes nearer. Because last time I didn't vote, so probably it's the same thing again.
Okay, Sheila, thank you very much for calling in. Lisa, in terms of a strategy, and our politicians that we have today are recovering politicians, former politicians, so they are in the know on how all of this works. If it's not working for Justin Trudeau to make every promise imaginable, including 3.9 million homes by 2031, what strategy should he be implementing in these final months, year and a half?
Well, let's pull back a second and say, well, what strategy should the Liberal Party of Canada be putting in place? Because their strategy and Mr. Trudeau's strategy may not be the same thing.
Okay.
And I don't think we're at that point yet where they wonder whether or not they do switch horses and have Mr. Trudeau no longer as the leader going into the next election. But I would just offer this to any Liberal who's thinking about strategy right now. The ballot box question for the next election has been defined, and it's very clear. And you're going to be asked, do you think you're better off now than you were in 2015 when the Liberals were elected? Mm-hmm. That's a really tough hurdle for the Liberals to get over, given what's happened, because they're left in the position of explaining. And the adage in politics is, when you're explaining, you're losing.
I wonder, Sherry DeNovo, if the only way Justin Trudeau could win the next election or the next Liberal leader, should he decide to step down or be kicked out, if the only option is to find some dirt on Pierre Poilievre.
Well, I think that's not going to work, quite frankly. I mean, that has been tried with the Alex Jones recommendation. I think that, you know, really the Liberal brand, all that it takes for a Conservative to win is for Liberals to stay home. I mean, that's the simple reality. And I think your caller was very indicative of that. If mm-hmm. you don't know who you're voting for and you stay home and you don't vote, then those who are motivated will, their party's going to win. And I don't see a lot of motivated Liberals these days out there. And I think that's a real problem. It'll be interesting to see what happens after this budget. I think John's right in the sense that they'll see a little bit of a bump, but how long that will last. Should Trudeau, it's a Trudeau cult in Ottawa. I don't see him leaving anytime soon.
Okay, I think we've exhausted the pre-budget chat. A budget coming down after the markets close at 4 o'clock today from Chrystia Freeland. And you'll want to tune into Zoomer Radio to get comprehensive coverage on the budget and what it means to Zoomers and the children of Zoomers. Let's switch now and talk about, well, it's partially a federal issue, but how the provincial government and the federal government have come to an agreement that will see the Feds drop an environmental assessment pertaining to the developing of the controversial Highway 413. Does this development ensure that the highway will be built, or is it still too early to say that? John, I'll start with you.
Well, I mean, I think now they have the green light. My understanding is there's going to be a joint panel that's going to work through any environmental issues. I mean, listen, I personally opposed to Highway 413. The Liberals fought an election against the Conservatives. They didn't do very well. And neither did any of the other parties. They got a majority. And at the end of the day, if that they have a mandate, they want to go through with it. Mm-hmm. And I get frustrated sometimes as a former provincial politician when people think somehow Ottawa is a big brother or a big sister who's going to swoop in and stop a provincial project which has a mandate from voters to move forward. So although I'm not happy about 413 going through, I think it was sort of ridiculous to think somehow the federal government was going to stop it on this technicality on, you know, the sort of federal piece of the environmental puzzle. So, you know, if the province wants to do it, I think the federal government's got to work with it to go through, no matter how unhappy that may make many people, and it'll probably start to go through.
Well, Doug Ford won a second majority in part on Highway 413. He campaigned on that 2 years ago. He won a majority, a bigger majority. So clearly people in the 905 are interested in this Highway 413. I guess when you're looking at taxpayer money across the board, Lisa, is it the solution? Is this Highway 413 enough of a difference maker from, say, the 407 if you were to remove tolls or buy the 407 as taxpayers? Is this the answer to traffic problems north of Toronto?
I don't think it's an answer to the traffic problems, but I think it's part of a package of decisions that have to be taken. And I would just point, Jane, to the influx of new Canadians that we've experienced in the past 2 years, 2 million people, and a large proportion of them have come to settle in the GTHA area and beyond. As a result, for us to say that we can survive on the current infrastructure of roads, I think is not a good path forward in terms of prosperity for our area. So this is good news to me that they've made the agreement. I think it actually bodes well for investment in the province, seeing the fact that the feds and the province can actually agree on something, because regulatory uncertainty is a killer of any private investment.
And Sherry, how confident do you feel, based on everything we've been hearing over the last day, that issues around the environment, species at risk of extinction, lakes, rivers, green belt land, that will be prioritized in trying to build this thing?
Well, I don't think it will at all. In fact, Farmers has spoken up. It's going to eat up some of the green belt. I mean, from an environmental standpoint, it's a disaster. But I think what's happening out there, and clearly the polls show this, is that when you're having a hard time paying your mortgage, you can't find a place that's affordable to rent, food's more expensive, interest in the environment tends to wane, and interest in how am I going to get by increases. And that's what I think you're seeing. So I'm sad about it. I think it's a terrible move environmentally, but then the Conservatives don't seem to have an environmental program, period. So, and I think the problem is that it's a meat and potatoes issue now in Canada. People are suffering and something has to be done. And you can't do one without the other.
You know, it's supposed to save 30 minutes in each direction for people who would take the 413. But Lisa, what about that question around the 407? And whether we should buy that back and then take the tolls off the 407, are we looking at kind of a similar scenario to what the 403 will cost to build?
No, I think it's far more expensive to do that with the 407.
Yeah.
But I'm sure some people are taking a look at it, whether or not that's viable. It's a very popular investment with the owners of it. They are doing very well with it. And it was set up in a way that maybe we should have thought twice about how it was set up in the past, but you can't necessarily go back and redo it. So it would be interesting to see how the province approaches the 407 as an alternate, but I don't see it happening right now.
Okay, we will leave it there. Hope you all enjoy watching and listening to the budget later on, and we will chat with you again next Tuesday.
Thanks, Jane.
Thanks, Jane.
Thanks, Jane.
It is our Recovering Politicians panel. Sherry DeNova, former NDP MPP. John Molloy, filling in for George Smitherman, former Ontario Liberal Cabinet Minister. And Lisa Raitt, former Federal Conservative Deputy Leader. Always great perspectives on the political issues of the day. It is Jane for Libby, and still to come. It was a lofty and impressive goal, providing 4 hours of direct care per nursing home resident in Ontario every day by next year. But now it looks like that's not going to happen. We discuss the ramifications, repercussions with an expert next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is having a busy day here at the Zoomer Flex. She is recording a program for Zoomer TV on our sister station Vision TV, and you'll hear more about that in the days to come. If you were listening to the Morning Zoom with Sam and Jane, us, this morning, then you likely heard about the ghost ride that was held last evening on Bayview Avenue, where Vladimir Zhotov was struck and killed by a driver earlier this month. And a ghost bike has been installed where he was hit near the Evergreen Brickworks. The artist who makes these ghost bikes says it's his sixth memorial in the GTA and third for Toronto this year alone. This got us wondering whether safety is improving or worsening for Toronto cyclists. What are your thoughts, whether you're a cyclist or a driver? 416-360-0740, 1-866-740-4740, toll free. Joining us to discuss, Albert Cole. He's a cycling and pedestrian advocate and an environmental lawyer. And Fraser Chapman, president and co-founder of the Morning Glory Cycling Club, of which Vladimir was a member. Thank you both for your time.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you. Fraser, thank you for having us.
Fraser, we're so sorry for your community's loss. Can you tell us about Vlad a little bit?
He was the kind of guy who just got up and went. He, every morning, it was a get up and go mentality. He had a massive smile on his face. He full of enthusiasm, father of three. Left behind, his wife is now a widow, and he was just a sensational human being.
So what happened from what you know?
Well, the police aren't saying much due to their investigation, but there was a motor vehicle exiting the DVP and wanting to enter onto Bayview, the Bayview Extension North, at 9:04:05 a.m. on Monday of last week. And Vlad was out for a morning ride. He was by himself. He was just out getting some exercise and some fresh air, and unfortunately resulted in his death.
How common is this, Albert? Are we hearing more about cyclist deaths, or does it just feel like we're hearing more when we hear sad stories like what's happened to Vladimir?
Well, first I'll express my condolences to Fraser and, of course, to Vlad's family. It's an ongoing situation. We know every year we'll have, from 1 to 5 cyclists killed on our roads. We still see about 60 people being killed on our roads, whether drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists. So it's anytime something like this happens, it is a failure of our Vision Zero plan, which does, look forward to a day when we have zero serious injuries or deaths on our road. We know on this particular stretch of road, Bayview, the speed limit is marked 60. It used to be 50. We know at 60 that someone hit that has very little chance of survival. So it is a failure of our Vision Zero plan, and we certainly look forward to the day where we don't have these tragedies to be talking about.
Albert, what about across the rest of the city? We know that bike lanes were prioritized during the pandemic. And in fact, there are bike lanes in the city which are not well used. Out in my neighborhood on Bloor West between Islington and Jane is an example. But in terms of the cycling infrastructure, where it's necessary and where it's used, how are we doing with that?
The goal is to establish a network. So there's going to be any network. There's going to be some areas that are just as there are areas that are not particularly frequented by cars. I mean, we still don't have a proper network of bike lanes in the city. And unfortunately, we still see, slow progress on installations. The only year we've actually met our targets, the bike plan targets, which right now are about 33 kilometers a year. The only year we've met that was in 2020, and it took a global pandemic. So we need to do much better. We need motorists to say, you know, we're part of this. We want to see cyclists safe on our roads. We don't want to see those kinds of tragedies. So it's really a community objective to see bike lanes installed. And I'll also say, bike lanes aren't simply for cyclists. I mean, what bike lanes do is they provide a buffer to sidewalks. So if you're pushing a baby stroller on the sidewalk, you're much happier to have that safety buffer of a bike lane, whether you live in Etobicoke or you live in Scarborough, anywhere in the city.
That's a good point. Fraser, what are your observations around the cycling network, how we're doing in the city, even in light of the loss of your friend?
It's difficult because, you know, you have motor vehicles using the road and then you have vulnerable road users. And vulnerable road users come in all shapes and sizes. As you say, you could have the young family pushing a stroller, or you could have somebody walking their dog. You could have somebody running, rollerblading, or on several different types of bicycles, all of which move at different pace, all of which are looking for a certain road surface. So I think that, education for both motor vehicles and vulnerable road users is very important. But I don't, our city is just, it's getting large. It's mm-hmm. huge. It's becoming bigger and bigger. And there are more and more people using our roads without more roads being developed. So it's a difficult one. But from a cycling perspective, there's, people who are moving at 15 kilometers an hour and people who are looking to move at 45 kilometers an hour. And right now, our infrastructure does not allow for that diversity.
And Fraser, what are members of your cycling club, how are they feeling about riding their bikes in the wake of Vladimir's death? I mean, is there some hesitancy out there now? I mean, when you think about Bayview Avenue and Albert's comment that it's now 60K an hour, how safe do you feel traveling on your bike on a road like that?
Well, I would say that probably several hundred people have come up to me and said that my first ride back after Vlad's death was a nervous one. Yeah. And I think that's, obviously very expected and very difficult. The whole community is devastated, and not even, including or thinking about Vlad's family. So I think the city has a really big challenge ahead of itself. It needs to kind of stand up and take ownership. And, people have the good fortune of living in the city and live a very nice life and do a great job, should be able to get outside without fear of being struck or killed or maimed or injured in any way.
Mm-hmm. Albert, how are we doing here in Toronto, the growing city of Toronto, when compared to other cycling cities around the world?
Well, it used to be that we'd point to Copenhagen and Amsterdam and say, wouldn't it be great if we could be like that? But we no longer have to look that far afield. Anyone that's been to Montreal recently can see that their network is so much more elaborate than ours is here in Toronto. So that's a smaller city. That's a city that's colder in the winter, and yet their cycling infrastructure is about twice that of Toronto. So if we're looking for inspiration, we only need to look to Montreal to do better.
And final comments from you, Fraser. If you were speaking to City Council, if you were talking about what you would like to see as a cyclist as part of a Safe Streets Toronto, what would you advocate for?
That's a difficult one. really. To stand in front of city council, there's, you know, many things that we could ask for, but we have to be realistic in terms of what they can deliver. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think safe streets and what that means to various people, it means different things to different people. So I really don't have an answer for you, because I don't think there is an immediate answer. But I do believe this is a topic that needs to be on their agenda, that has to be on their radar. And you just can't have people going out, leaving the house for a morning workout and not coming home.
It is an ongoing conversation for sure. Thank you both for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Fraser Chapman is president and co-founder of the Morning Glory Cycling Club, and Albert Cole is a cycling and pedestrian advocate and an environmental lawyer. Jane for Libby, who is back tomorrow with the medical record panel. Up next, Bob Komsic and the news.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby returns with the medical record panel tomorrow on Wednesday. This past September, when Stan Cho took over as Ontario's long-term care minister, he received a briefing that the province may not be able to meet the goal of providing 4 hours of direct daily care for all nursing home residents by next year. The main issue is a staffing shortage. The document was retrieved by the Canadian Press via a Freedom of Information request, and it shows that in Ontario, there is a need for more than 13,000 nurses and 37,700 personal support workers. But are we making any kind of dent in these numbers? Do you have a loved one in long-term care? And what is your current experience with how many hours a day they received in direct one-on-one care? 416-360-0740 or toll-free 1-866-744-740. How many hours on average of one-on-one care do you feel that your loved one receives, your loved one who's in a nursing home? Again, the numbers 416-360-0740. 1-866-744-740. Your experiences really do help tell the story, so we encourage you to call in. Joining us to discuss, a long-term care advocate, Dr. Vivian Stamatopoulos, professor at Ontario Tech University, who conducts research on long-term care issues. Dr. Vivian, how have you been?
I've been well. How are you?
Oh, very good. It's great to talk with you again.
You too.
What is your reaction to this document that it's now being acknowledged?
Yeah, this is laughable. I mean, keep in mind, this government, the PC government, the Ford government, released the staffing study, which was a remnant of the Galise inquiry. So if you remember, Elizabeth Wetlaufer killed all those long-term care residents and is now in jail for that. Out of that came a public inquiry and a staffing study that was released in September 2020 under former Minister Fullerton. So we have the results that this sector was in crisis well before COVID, and certainly in the, we know what happened during COVID. And all that this government has done throughout COVID, for anyone that's been paying attention, has made matters worse. So I find it interesting, and I say that, you know, very, you know, targetedly, that they're confused that there's a systemic shortage of nurses and PSWs across the sector when they have been told over and over things that they need to do to improve the conditions of work in these facilities to attract and retain workers. I mean, we have a revolving door in long-term care that they know about, and any of your callers that call in will tell you that you have people in and out of these facilities, and this government has made it easier for temporary staffing agencies to further break continuity of care by allowing workers not to have any permanence at one facility and to filter into multiple facilities holding multiple part-time jobs at many homes, even though we knew that that was one of the biggest reasons that the illness spread so fast and furious during COVID, right?
Yes.
So they've done nothing but aggravate the staffing agency situation, which is a big part of this problem. And Bill 124 was probably the biggest thing that they did to drive nurses away in the first place across the sectors, not just long-term care. So, I mean, look inwards, people, government, Ford, Sylvia Jones, Minister Cho, they know exactly how we got to where we are right now, and they have nobody to blame but themselves.
What, help us or put in perspective for us these most recent numbers from September of 2023. A need for more than 13,000 nurses, 37,000 personal support workers. How does that compare to the report you were referencing in 2020?
So what they have done, keep in mind, when everything went, you know, where it went in the trash can during COVID and what happened in long-term care to these poor residents, there was a long-term care commission. Out of that long-term care commission that the Ford government themselves commissioned, it was, you know, one of the results from the commissioner said, we need a four-hour care standard. So this was them saying, okay, we're not going to give it to you now, which is mind-blowing, but we'll give it to you by 2025, averaging, you know, a little bit this year, a little bit this year, a little bit next year, et cetera. And what we're finding out today is that not only have they likely not met this year's March 2024 benchmark of 3 hours and 42 minutes, but that we're currently standing, as far as we know, at just over 3 hours of daily minutes per care. Keep in mind, experts say that we should be between 6 to 7 hours. That four-hour benchmark is wholly inadequate. I testified in front of the legislature about this very benchmark that was actually created well over a decade ago with outdated information. So not only are we starting with a pittance of 4 hours as a desired goal by 2025, we can't even get to 3.5 hours. And we know for a fact we need to be around the 6 to 7 hour mark. So we're not getting anywhere near where we should be. And obviously, this is all tied to the conditions of work in these facilities. So, look at how these workers are treated.
Right. So you're saying that at the moment, we don't know for sure, but it's around 3 hours per resident of direct one-on-one care.
Yeah, what we found out today, thanks to this Freedom of Information request, by the way, they didn't willingly give us this information. Thank God for the Canadian media that finds this information through Freedom of Information requests. And this is the state of our government that they have to do this in order to get relevant statistics. But that aside, you know, we only know that as of March 2023, they met that standard of 3 hours and 15 minutes. And this whole report today that came out from the Toronto Star is intimating that we probably won't meet the March 2024 deadline of 3 hours and 42 minutes.
Right, right.
So,
Okay, so let's talk about, because I think this part would be interesting from our listeners' perspective as well, for those of you who have a loved one in long-term care, the amount of care that you would estimate they're getting directly from staff on a daily basis. Again, the numbers 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. I'm joined by Dr. Vivian Stamatopoulos, long-term care advocate, expert. So Dr. Vivian, help paint a picture for us of that amount of time. Like, what amount of time is required for one-on-one care of a nursing home resident to ensure that they're living safely and comfortably?
I mean, 6 hours. But keep in mind,
break that down. Can you break that down for us? Like,
well,
in terms of
keep in mind, bathing, feeding, providing medications, and none of this even accounts for just spending time with the residents. These places are so lonely, and I know having spent the better part of a year with a loved one in a facility right before COVID hit, so I know what these places are like. Firsthand experience, my expertise aside, I've lived this sector. I know what these families have seen and what they are dealing with now is even worse than what, you know, I experienced myself pre-pandemic in a system that was already chronically understaffed. So, you know, we don't factor in time to actually socialize with these residents, really. Yeah. They're often in their rooms alone by themselves. If family aren't present, you know, visiting, they get slim to no socialization because there aren't enough staff. The staff are literally running off their feet, just trying to give them their food, their medications, bathe them. And even that isn't happening as much as it should. And to the quality it should be. You know, we just don't treat these residents with dignity. And we could if we actually factored in policy that enabled dignified working conditions. Because keep in mind, at the end of the day, it's the conditions of work. And Dr. Pat Armstrong, who I know well, has said this most succinctly. The conditions of work become the conditions of care. Mm. When you look at the overwhelmingly underpaid, overworked PSW workforce, roughly 60% of the entire Ontario long-term care workforce are personal support workers. Keep in mind, this is an unregulated profession that earns often under $20 an hour. And most of them are part-time, even though we have studies that show that they want full-time work. So ask yourself why these facilities, which the majority of which are for-profit, are refusing to give these workers full-time permanent work at one facility. Give me a break. What these governments are allowing these often for-profit providers to do is to create profit through dangerous staffing processes, which effectively create an Uber-style workforce in one of the most vulnerable sectors. And that's exactly what's happening here. They could easily mandate that, for example, 70% of the workforce is full-time permanent. Why can't they do that? I've even talked to our prime minister about mandating a national standard around that very simple 70-30 quota. That would do wonders. Wonders to improving this sector.
Okay, Dr. Vivian, let's go to the phones. John in Toronto wants in on the conversation. John, thanks for calling. What would you like to add?
A friend of mine had his mother put into a nursing home, and they always have to hire additional PSWs to be a companion.
Right.
And can you, in closing, can you imagine what this government's going to be up against in 10 years with a million people waiting to go into long-term care?
Yeah. John, wow. Excellent call. Thank you so much. And you know, my late former mother-in-law spent a lot of time in the nursing home with her, visiting, of course, my husband, it was his mother, and we would show up on purpose around lunchtime so we could help with the feeding, because the PSWs, they simply cannot... they cannot make it happen all at once. And Dr. Vivian, this is now going back 7-8 years. I mean, this is a chronic problem in our system that doesn't seem to be getting fixed.
No. And listen, like, obviously many governments have their hand in this. And this is a larger problem with, you know, systemic ageism here. There is nowhere where ageism is more glaring in practice than long-term care. What happened throughout the pandemic was just a live natural experiment on how badly you can fail a group of vulnerable people that the governments, frankly, don't deem worth putting the resources in. For, I can go on for this for hours about how the hospitals got all the funding and the vast majority of the funding, the PPE, the resources, while long-term care, which was the sector on fire during the first two waves, got none of the support. Got like 10% if we're looking at a pie of 100% of the support. Why? The majority older female disabled seniors. Give me a break. And I've had this fight at the federal level as well, because I don't think we can rely on any one even provincial government to do exactly what needs to be done. But we need to tie money to federal funds going towards long-term care. And that's something I've been trying to push our prime minister to do, because we're going to need all levels of government. And you know what they've all been doing is kicking the can further down the road, hoping the next government will do what needs to get done. And we're so sick of it, because we know what's coming. The quote unquote silver tsunami of baby boomers. This is going to get very bad very quickly. If these governments don't wake up, pull their heads out of the sand and realize that you can only avoid this problem for so long, lest we literally turn on the TV and hear one horror story after another nonstop, because that's where we're going right now.
And what about Dr. Vivian, and I want to get back to the phones here as well, but what about giving more priority, giving more acknowledgement to people who want to become PSWs, nurses working in long-term care, giving them better money? Would that solve some of the problem in attracting people to that field?
Well, there's two main things they have to do, and this is very clear and easy. If they actually wanted to do it, they just need to pay these workers far more than what they're being paid. It's atrocious that they're being paid barely survivable wages when they're caring for one of the most medically complex populations, keep in mind. And second, it's the conditions of work. And the way to get at forcing these providers to hire appropriate numbers of staff is indeed a firm care standard. The care standard that we're talking about today, because this government yet again has dropped the ball on. So if you actually hold firm limits, like have the 4-hour care standard right now, you will force these providers to have to hire more staff. It's not that they can't. Give me a break. These people are making money hand over fist. The profits, the billions in profits that many of these largest for-profit corporations make is astounding. So don't kid yourself. It's not like they've been that hurt during COVID. They get a steady stream of public funding to run these facilities. And then what do? They skim off the top in the way of staffing first and foremost, and then resources and the amount of incontinence pads. You should hear the horror stories that I've heard about what the difference is between, for example, municipal homes and for-profit homes. These are choices. These are choices that these for-profit companies are doing, and this government, who seems to love for-profit industry, is just allowing them and actually making it easier for them to profit off our most vulnerable.
Okay.
And frankly, they should all be ashamed.
We just have a minute or so left. I want to get to Wanda in Mississauga and then a final comment from Dr. Vivian. Wanda, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I'm outraged that the fact that everybody pays to go to these long care homes, yet they don't get the care they need.
Yeah.
There's something wrong. I'm going to be 62 this year. It's a very scary situation. I hope I never have to go to one.
I hear you.
Kept my mom at home till she died. Thankfully, she only went there for 2 weeks and passed at the hospital. So God help anybody that's got to go in a nursing home. They said they were going to fix it for COVID. It's been 4 years. No changes. Sad world, bad government.
Thank you, Wanda. Carolyn in Halliburton just called. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on the PSW situation. I have a family member who is being looked after at home. He gets three PSWs a day, and which is a designated 3 hours, supposedly. I don't dispute the issue of paying them better at all. But what my concern and the issue we're dealing with right now is, with a few exceptions, the PSWs that we are getting are not equipped or qualified to offer the most basic care. And the situation has gotten to the point where they're supposed to come the morning, noon, and after 4:30. They show up anywhere a couple of hours either side of those benchmarks. Quite often, my daughter will get a phone call saying, "Do you want me now?" And it's 3 o'clock, and this is from the person who's supposed to show up after 4:30. A situation the other day where they sent a new person and she didn't even know how to make a sandwich.
Okay.
It's really, really sad. And if they came when they were supposed to come, it would be working. The other thing is, I don't know. I could go on about
it. I hear you. No, and I'm pushing my time as well. Carolyn, thank you so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
And there are others who I'm not going to be able to get to. We have one more segment in Fight Back, so I don't want to reduce the importance on the next topic. But Dr. Vivian, real quick, just final comments, if you could.
She's right. She's right. And training is the third issue, right? So if we're looking at the big pillars, it's the conditions of work, meaning the care standard, forcing these places to, you know, hire more workers at a bare minimum, but the training. So there's no doubt she's right there. And a lot of that is because we allowing these private agencies to just send people with often fraudulent reports. I just did a story about a fake nurse that was sent to multiple long-term care homes by a private agency that just sprouted up during COVID. I mean, people need to look closer at what's happening here, because things are getting more and more dangerous by the day. And it is a shame that after 4 years, we're in a worse situation than we were before.
Long-term care advocate Dr. Vivian Stamatopoulos at Ontario Tech University, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And still to come here on Fight Back, Jane for Libby, how safe are cyclists on the streets of Toronto? Is it getting better or worse? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.